What we want to do is actually live in a country where fewer people develop chronic conditions. And when somebody needs care, the kind of care that they need is really prevention and health promotion much more frequently than the kind of care that is currently being sort of the dominant care that is delivered. We're trying to turn that around, and we're trying to create a path that really moves us all forward as a nation, because what we currently have is not sustainable. And I say this with a lot of commitment and respect and determination. Nurses can provide solutions to the most challenging issues that we face as a country, and we've got to get people to see that.
Welcome to the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing podcast, Aging Fast and Slow. This podcast is supported by the National Institute on Aging Pioneer Award. Thanks for listening. We are Dr. Sarah Zanton
and Dr. Deidre Cruz, your hosts. For the past several seasons, we have been exploring the dynamics of structural racism. In this season, we shift our focus to the extraordinary power of structural resilience. We will talk with scientists, thought leaders, and innovators about the importance of resilience that extends beyond the individual level to include communities and policies.
Policy issues play a pivotal role in shaping the structural resilience of communities. The interplay between policies, social determinants of health, and structural resilience can either bolster or hinder a community's ability to navigate adversity. We'll talk today about a thoughtful examination of policy frameworks as they impact the social, economic, and environmental factors that contribute to a community's overall resilience.
To explore this nexus, we are joined by Dr. Vincent Guillamo Ramos, Director of the Institute of Policy Solutions at the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing. His research examines the role of families in promoting adolescent and young adult health, with a focus on mitigating the mechanisms through which harmful social determinants of health shape health inequities. Our discussion will delve into the nuanced ways in which policy decisions intersect with community dynamics and influence long-term well-being and adaptive capabilities of diverse populations. Welcome, Vincent.
Thank you so much for having me, Deidre and Sarah. It's a pleasure to be here.
We are thrilled. We are thrilled that you've recently moved to Johns Hopkins and thrilled to be able to interview you this morning. So we'd like to start with what brought you to this work? What has been your path to come be here with us today?
I think when I look back at sort of what led me to this point, probably what stands out first and foremost is, you know, my parents and my family. That, you know, I was born in the South Bronx in a community that is 75% Latino and 25% African American. And at the time when I was growing up, I didn't really have a vocabulary for that difference, but I did know that a few miles away in Manhattan, things were quite different. I'd look out the window and the neighborhoods looked different, the housing looked different. And, you know, that understanding as I got older grew, and I learned that a big part of what was shaping sort of what I saw in my own neighborhood were the conditions, the social conditions in which families, including my own, what we lived in. And so in my community, it was really shaped by high levels of economic disadvantage, by the absence of health and social service. There were lots of challenges around health, around things like chronic disease, or what really captured my attention as I progressed in my own career was sexual and reproductive health. To be honest, at the time, I incorrectly thought that they were perhaps associated with my neighborhood or with the people that lived in my community. I didn't have a way of really thinking about, well, why is it that these unequal and these disparate outcomes are happening time and time again to people that live in this particular context, the South Bronx? That kind of led me to first a career in social work. And the reason why I pursued social work is because I became fascinated by social justice and the idea that really that there were individuals that were experiencing unjust, unfair structural factors that were shaping what happened in their lives. And that really resonated with me. That led me to really want to move into community interventions. And I combined the work that I've been doing in social work, which I did for many, many years, into a career that also encompassed public health, and in particular epidemiology, and understanding, well, what kinds of risk factors and what kinds of interventions could be developed in communities. And throughout all of that, you know, I kind of had this sort of lingering voice inside of me that said, you know, you really have a deep interest in providing direct care to people. And I wanted to provide the kind of care that would incorporate social welfare, public health, and then what I later understood was nursing. And so for me, you know, Deidre and Sarah, what was really sort of the right path was being a nurse. And I'm proud today to be a nurse. I'm proud to be a nurse that still heavily identifies with my public health and social work origins. And I see that kind of interprofessional training as really being what I had wanted if I had just pursued nursing and actually could have gotten that from my nursing education. I would have wanted those three perspectives into the kind of nurse that today I am, but I would have loved to have been trained. To be honest, I'm smiling. Viewers can't see my smile.
We can see it.
But I'm smiling because I would have loved to have had just one degree. That was a nursing degree that actually provided me with.
Where's the fun in that?
Well, Johns Hopkins will be leading the way in that.
No, that's terrific. So how would you say that social determinants of health manifest within the specific context that we might see in underserved communities? And what key factors do you think that then lead to health disparities that are sort of born in those settings?
Well, thanks for the question, Deidre. I mean, I think the first thing that I would say is that, you know, I typically use the word inequities, and I'm very intentional about that. I think sometimes folks will use negative health outcomes, or they may use the word disparities, but I actually use the word inequities because it really speaks to the unjust, unfair, clustered negative outcomes that time and time again impact the same individuals, families, communities. You know, a lot of my training, and I'm very grateful for my nursing training, but it tended to focus on clinical expertise. And so typically what would happen, and I think, you know, many of us can relate to this who are healthcare professionals, certainly nurses, there was a focus on a particular body part or a system or a condition. Mm-hmm. And it's almost as if we became quite knowledgeable, but just about that one aspect of what was happening. Mm-hmm. But what was often missing was what later I discovered was really the lion's share of what accounted for the variability. And that was really the broader context. And so for me, the social determinants come up in many ways. You know, they come up when we see the sort of co-occurring chronic conditions. It's not just, you know, HIV, it's an unplanned pregnancy, it's not just hypertension. It goes along with other things. A major depressive disorder, or typically there are other things that are happening that time and time again are impacting the same individuals. Mm-hmm. I also was very cognizant that it wasn't just about sort of individual level factors, right? It was certainly the institutions in our society, in our communities, they play an important role. And so if you think about, for example, just to use another one that was sort of near and dear to my work, think about MPOX.
And for our listeners who might not know what MPOX is, could you give a sentence or two defining it?
Sure. So MPOX it's a virus that historically has been transmitted by being in close contact to somebody that is infected. It has for, you know, many, many years been primarily in African countries. But in the United States, there was transmission of this particular virus, and it was associated with physical contact through sexual behavior. And it led to sort of a spike in cases, particularly among men who have sex with men.
Great.
You know, at the time when MPOX was really emerging in the United States, I was living in North Carolina. I remember looking at the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, their website, where they were reporting on who is it in the state that is developing an MPOX infection. And it was mostly African-American men who have sex with men. When I looked at the distribution of the vaccine that would prevent active infection with MPOX, 7 out of 10 vaccines were going to non-African-American individuals. Yeah. 7 out of 10 of the infections were among Black MSM in the state. Complete disconnect between where the greatest risk and need is in the distribution of resources. And so why I bring that up is because later what we saw was sort of an escalation of a narrative that was African MSM were most likely to have MPOX or became associated with the Black MSM in North Carolina. The truth is that was happening, but the part that wasn't being reported was the distribution of the vaccine. And I could use many examples across many health inequities where the distribution of resources, who gets care, who doesn't get care, who has access, what kind of care, that also contributes to the negative health inequities that we see. Those are decisions that we make in terms of allocation of the resources and how our institutions operate. All of those things come together and they create the inequities that we see that too often get explained as being about somebody being Latino or Black or Native American or whatever it may be that is their, you know, minoritized group status.
You just talked about MPOX and the differential impact. Can you tell us about community-led initiatives that have successfully tackled social determinants, promoted structural resilience, and how we might learn from these examples, particularly in the realm of MPOX?
What a great question, Sarah. I love that question. I think there's sort of three parts that I hear. So one is I'm hearing about sort of successful strategies. I'm hearing about this important idea of resilience and community resilience, and then also hearing about social determinants. And so I want to start by saying that I think not too long ago, there wasn't that much recognition that social determinants really played an important role in our health and public health response. Over time, there's been sort of a steady increase, and probably in about 2010 is when we really see an escalation of real attention in science, in scholarship, and also in applied public health and health programmatic approaches to addressing the important context in which people live. I think what's been challenging is that too often that has meant really screening and documenting and then making referrals to what often are referred to as wraparound providers or, you know, psychosocial community-based organizations or social welfare entities that then address whatever the social need is. I don't want in any way suggest that isn't an important thing to do. You know, when people come in and they have social needs, we absolutely want to address those needs, but it's inadequate. And it actually is a pretty static approach. It doesn't really look at what are some of the mechanisms that are really driving the inequity. And if we were to align the kinds of interventions that we do both at the individual level as nurses, but also at the family level, at the community level, in our policies, with greater understanding of the actual mechanisms by which those social determinants are enacting their influence on the negative health inequity, we would have much more effective interventions. When I think about my sort of nursing lens, my social work lens, my public health lens, it's really clear to me that the evidence suggests that resilient policies foster a preventative approach. They really meet people where they are. They consider them as whole people. They appeal to their strengths, and they try to think about the kinds of behaviors that folks engage in as being normative given the set of options they have before them. And so how can we think about turning that around? And if we think about sort of the underlying reasons why someone might be using a substance, then once we take that lens, what might policy look like if it reflected a commitment to making these populations more resilient or helping them to be more resilient? Very different lens. And the reason why I offer this is because I don't think it can just be about, you know, do better, try harder. If you're successful, it's because you earned it. The cream rises to the top. I think that's not true. I think the cream oftentimes gets pushed to the top.
Nice.
It's a great nugget. So, Vincent, in one of your recent publications, you laid out a really innovative roadmap for mitigating harmful social determinants of health that pretty adequately considers the roles of exposure, susceptibility, social processes, as well as resilience in shaping health inequity. Can you tell us how this framework, in your view, bolsters strength-based resilience factors that can really set communities up to thrive despite some of the adversity that we've talked about?
You know, I would say that first and foremost, the framework was really a critical review of all the dominant scholarship and models that have been developed around social determinants of health. And there are many, and there are some that are fantastic. And so I want to make sure that I'm recognizing that work, because certain of these ideas, they didn't solely come from my group or from, you know, our own thinking. They were heavily informed by what had been there prior to our thinking about this literature. Having said that, I think part of what we discovered was that often there were certain kinds of factors that were missing. For example, resilience, for example, susceptibility, for example, exposure. There was a lack of attention to the family context. There was an omission of the mechanisms by which social determinants are shaping the negative health inequity. What there was that was a great strength was a lot of complexity and recognition around the multifactorial kinds of things that represent social determinants. But it was hard to sort of figure out, what do you do once you've assessed that somebody has housing instability or food insecurity, or someone may be experiencing systemic and structural racism? What do you do, and what is the most effective way that you can intervene, both from a life course perspective, in a multi-level way, and also in a way that honors the person's resilience? And that was missing, Deirdre. And so what was really nice about the framework is that we wanted to have it be evidence-based, but generic enough that if you were working within a particular sort of geographic area, let's imagine that we were doing like what we're doing right now at Hopkins at the School of Nursing, a project in Baltimore that is being held up, that's called Neighborhood Nursing. It's a particular geography. And so in a particular spatial sort of temporal context, right now, this particular neighborhood, there may be a set of inequities that are co-occurring that we want to try to mitigate. And so what the framework does really nicely is that it walks you back and helps you to think about, well, what are the exposures? What are the susceptibility factors? How does a life course perspective play into this? What is happening at the family level that is contributing to how the family is either adapting, coping, trying to address, or is it that the family is also experiencing the inequity in ways that are harmful to the unit, not just the individuals? It has, you know, attention to not only the traditional sort of what I call social determinants capital. You know, do people have things like health insurance or housing or food, which are important, but what often gets neglected are things like structural and systemic racism or homophobia or anti-immigrant sentiment. These are things that we know are also shaping an individual. We have lots of evidence that there are biological changes that occur when people experience these negative social processes. The framework also asks us to consider not just the individual, but the broader context. You know, what are the institutions doing? And then the broader policies, how do those things facilitate the health and well-being, or do they also provide challenges? If we have a national ending the HIV epidemic plan, but we have states that say that certain kinds of preventative treatments like PrEP.
Is it pre-exposure prophylaxis?
Yeah.
So PrEP is pre-exposure prophylaxis. It's actually a prevention pill or injection that can be offered to people who are HIV negative, who don't have HIV and are concerned about acquiring the infection or are worried that they might be at risk. And so certain kinds of preventative treatments like PrEP can be taken off of the reimbursement because maybe there's religious objection, which then leaves people in that context less likely to be protected. Their susceptibility increases. Just as an example, these things are related and they help me to understand when I'm thinking about interventions as a neuroscientist, where do I want to target my efforts? And it allows multiple places for intervention. And so in that way, Deirdre, that's what the model's about. It's a way of organizing my thinking so that I can align the intervention target with a particular mechanism that is shaping whatever those inequities are in that context.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
Okay, so switching to policy, you talked about policy a little bit, and you're now the executive director of the Institute for Policy Solutions at the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing, as we mentioned at the top. And in what ways do you see health policy being able to be adapted or enhanced to better support a whole community's ability to rebound from health-related challenges, including ensuring equitable access to resources and services?
You know, it took me many years in my career to get to a place where I now see policy as being very important, if not the most important place in terms of where nurses can make a contribution to improving our nation's health. I also want to say, and this is something that, again, is very important for the listeners, and it's a nuanced point. It's one that's a very delicate point. You know, in our country today, the largest segment of our workforce is our health workforce is the nursing workforce. And too often that nursing workforce is largely invisible. And the thing that is tragic about this is that nurses have great proximity to the provision of care. We spend tons of time in our day-to-day roles with people, with families, and in communities. We are the witness to many of the things that are happening in terms of these health inequities. Because of that unique perspective, because of our clinical expertise, because of our leadership capacity and abilities, we are perfect for coming up with nurse-driven solutions. Solutions that are not about nursing, that are not about advancing solely one profession, but are really about tackling the most complex and challenging issues that we face as a nation. And so part of what I love about this new opportunity, what I'm so excited about with the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing and the Institute for Policy Solutions, is that together, the faculty, the leadership of the school, the leadership of the institute, and the students that are attending the School of Nursing at Hopkins, we are collectively working to really redesign health, to transform the way that our country thinks about health and well-being. What we want to do is actually live in a country where fewer people develop chronic conditions. And when somebody needs care, the kind of care that they need is really prevention and health promotion much more frequently than the kind of care that is currently being sort of the dominant care that is delivered, which is the care when one becomes sick and finds themselves in the hospital. We're trying to turn that around, and we're trying to create a path that really moves us all forward as a nation, because what we currently have is not sustainable. The cool part, and I'll sort of, you know, you can hear my excitement, and when I'll sort of wind up on this. And I'll say this with a lot of commitment and respect and determination. Nurses can provide solutions to the most challenging issues that we face as a country. And we've got to get people to see that.
Thank you, Vincent. And our listeners may have been feeling the joy here in the recording studio as well, as Vincent articulated our goals so nicely.
So, Vincent, what guidance would you offer to the next generation of researchers? And feel free, as you might want to think even particularly about nurse scientists, but also maybe about scientists even more broadly.
I would say pursue what you feel most passionate about. The start of our conversation today, we talked about my upbringing and what led me down this path. Those values, those things that were so fundamental to who I am today, have been what has largely framed my professional career. They are things that I care deeply about. They are things that motivate me and that keep me very focused on moving forward to try to create a more equitable country and broader world. And I think that what I would say to people in terms of advice is to really be open, but listen to what you care about most and align your energies to pursue that. Don't worry about people telling you that there's got to be a particular path, or that you can only be, you know, a nurse if you do A, B, and C. I don't believe that. I think that what each of us should do is really think about what is that goal that we are most interested in and pursue it and give it your full attention. And I have always had the experience that when I've done that, somehow the world has sort of conspire to help me to achieve what I'm trying to do. And, you know, the more that, you know, you are upfront, you are open, clear, that this is what you're about, this is what you want to accomplish. My experience has been that people step forward and say, hey, I want to help you to do that.
Nice.
That's great.
And a little more broadly, what would you say is one of the most valuable pieces of advice about anything, not necessarily your career, that you've ever received?
You know, I think the thing I would say is the most important advice I've received is to sort of silence the perspectives and voices that don't really foster what you see as being the vision for what you'd like in your life, whether it be your career or personally. Go forward with clarity about what you want to accomplish. You know, I'll give you a quick story, Sarah, that will resonate with you. You know, recently I was reading a report. You happen to be one of the people, Sarah, that was a member of this working group that issued a report through the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine that was really looking at healthcare financing and thinking through ways to align financing and payment with whole person care. And there was a section in the report that was using climate change and issues around climate as an exemplar of how sort of a larger movement or effort had been started and how it had escalated over time to being what it is today, that most people in the world see climate as a priority. And one of the arguments that was being made in the report was that we needed to do something similar in health. How could we create that same kind of social movement around the importance of health in our country and broader world? Part of that story was about individual people believing that this was important and that they could pursue and create such a movement. And so when I think of people like students or early career professionals or anybody that wants to have an impact on the world, I always remember that it takes one person to push, and over time that one person will multiply and eventually it can be a movement.
That's a great way to end. So thank you. Thank you.
For our listeners, check out our website, nursing.jhu.edu/agingfastandslow, for the articles and resources referenced in the episode. Have comments, questions, or guest suggestions? Reach out to us at agingfastandslow@jhu.edu.
And if you enjoyed this podcast, please share it with a friend, rate it, or write us a review. Special thanks to Jennifer McCord for editing and sound design, Rafe Reggie and Florentina Costaca for technical expertise, Brian Fitzik for production, and Tim Carl and Danielle Kress for web design. See you next time on Aging Fast and Slow.